I'll start. Yeah, so it's called A Buddhist Response to the Environmental Crisis. So I'm going to start actually talking about a geophysics conference that took place in America last year. And there was, so it's kind of a little bit of a story. So this guy called Brad Werner, he goes to the front of this conference. There's 24,000 people there. Obviously, they're all scientists, earth scientists, space scientists, geophysicists. And he goes to the front of the crowd to do his presentation on his climate model. So climate model, looking at the situation with regards to the current climate change scenarios and so forth. So he's talking about system boundaries, things like attractors, dissipation, and a whole load of other stuff to do with systems theories that probably nobody understands except those experts in the field. But the point being, and was very, very clear, that all the research was showing that we're going completely through the roof of all the estimates that we need to maintain to sort of to make a stable society in terms of climate. Yeah, it's looking particularly bad at the moment. But there was something that was quite interesting as part of his climate model that gave, well, I suppose, a degree of hope. And actually, this dynamic is about what he called it, Werner called it, resistance. So this is movements of people or groups of people who adopt a certain set of dynamics that doesn't fit within our current capitalist culture. Yeah, so it's groups of people that are causing resistance. So these groups of people, for example, like in people that call maybe members of 38 Degrees and groups like that, resistance outside dominant culture. So even blockades and sabotage, say Greenpeace, for example. And so indigenous peoples, people like anarchists even, these are people that are causing resistance to the current global culture. And these are actually having an effect potentially on climate change. So it looks like we actually need a revolution. So my question to you this evening is, are you in? Are you in the revolution? So I'm going to start with a poem from Ryokan, as I said, who was a wise fool. He's known as the wise fool. And he didn't have any disciples. And he didn't have a temple. And in the world, in the eyes of the world, he was just a penniless monk, and he lived his life in the Japanese mountains. So it's a very short poem, so you'll have to pay attention. And the poem is this: "For a memento of my existence, what shall I leave? I leave not leave anything. Flowers in the spring, cuckoos in the summer." So that's what he's leaving. Flowers in the spring, cuckoos in the summer. And that poem really appeals to me, just that, just leaving nature as it is, yeah, not stepping heavily on the world, the simple life. So in this talk, I'm not going to go into whether or not the environmental crisis is man-made or not. If you are in doubt and you're really not sure, as it were, there's plenty of scientific papers out there. There's lots of recordings of the carbon emissions and global warming reports. If you look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, if you want references, I've got them. The Stern Report, 99% of the scientific community are all saying, yeah, climate change is a consequence man-made. And even, pretty much everybody's on board, possibly not those paid off by the fossil fuel lobby groups, possibly not Daily Mail readers. But, you know, there you go. There's always people outside everybody else's consciousness. Sorry, Daily Mail readers. change your paper. Work done by all the scientists, ecologists and environmentalists all point to the fact that we're facing the greatest disaster our planet's ever seen. Increased pollution, the increase in species extinction, lack of food and water supplies, overpopulation, it's going to cause devastation on a global scale and far more greater suffering than will be caused by any war, any Holocaust, any disease or any natural disaster. This is what we're facing. So we should all be concerned about this. And obviously the response, the concern, goes way beyond, you know, any religion, any political party, any country. It's a global issue. And it's not affecting only all humankind, but actually all life, non-humans too. This is for Karen and Dee, even kittens. Let's say, life on Earth, as we know, is threatened. Our planet's under great pressure, and it can't balance out to reach any kind of equilibrium. And we've gone beyond what some people are calling the tipping point, which I'm not going to go into now. But we've gone too far. We've pushed it, and you can imagine what a tipping point is. We've gone over the edge. So if we carry on with our business as usual, with our sort of pursuit of profits and growth, we can be assured as to not if these disasters are going to happen, but when they're going to happen. As I suggested, we've already gone beyond current projections of this 2-degree agreement that was set in Copenhagen as part of the UN conference, which was to maintain 2 degrees global warming above pre-industrial levels. We've gone way, well, we're protecting maybe up to 5-6 degrees. So, so if you start really looking at it, it's pretty horrific. We're not designing, our infrastructure won't handle it. Can you imagine the underground in the middle of summer, as it is now, those that catch the underground, chuck another 8, 9, 10 degrees on that? Well, you won't need to, because they won't be able to run in that sort of scenario. So there's lots of things that I'm not going to go into, all the bits and pieces, but I'll give you some ideas. They're talking about an ice-free Arctic, just at 2 degrees. So if you can imagine an Arctic without ice, you can see sea level rises of tens of metres, i.e. no Bangladesh. That's pretty much assured, as it were, so then you're going to have population problems and so forth. This is all within the next century, basically. And if we don't act, and if we continue as it is, it's going to be a lot worse than that. So that's kind of the good picture. So that's like pretty dangerous, pretty awful, but it's going to actually be potentially worse than that. Yeah. So this is if we don't act. So I believe as Buddhists we should act. If we don't, the principles of love and compassion, the practices we do, Tonglen Metta, as it were, what the Buddha taught, that we're acting for the benefit of all beings, they just all become theoretical in my mind, and they have no practical use. So the idea that Buddhists should be there in a cave meditating, contemplating the navel, I think it's time to throw that idea out completely, actually. And if we're going to have to wait till we're full and perfectly enlightenment, if we wait till we're fully and perfectly enlightened, it will all be too late. So I think part of me, I was of that perspective that in order to really help beings, I need to be fully enlightened. I don't think we've got time, actually, anymore. I think let's just get on and help the world as much as we can with the skills we've got, with the gifts we've got to bring to the world. And I'm just going to read a little bit from a book called Soulcraft by a chap called Bill Plotkin. He's a bit of a shaman, actually, but it's a beautiful quote. "The gift you carry for others is not an attempt to save the world, but to fully belong to it. It's not possible to save the world by trying to save it. You need to find what is genuinely yours to offer to the world before you make it a better place. Discovering your unique gift to bring to your community is your greatest opportunity and challenge. The offering of your gift, your true self, is the most you can do to love and serve the world, and it is all the world needs." So this chap is kind of, well, I suppose he's coming from the same kind of story that I have, as it were. Our gift is ourselves to the world, and our practice will carry us. I'm quite confident about it. One could almost go into, well, what is enlightenment if we're not really of benefit to the world, you know? Maybe we need to rethink enlightenment and what that really is. So the current trend of trying to resolve the environmental crisis is kind of to use the same school of thought that created it in the first place. science is offering us new solutions, new technical solutions, but each technical advance we seem to make gets us into more trouble. I know Tom's talking about, well, about this technology in the next world. I don't know if you go into that at all. But we, you know, some of our technological solutions are, well, let's decarbonise the UK national electrical grid. But then we're going to do that, what, with nuclear power? And obviously, the recent Fukushima nuclear disaster, and we see again that, you know, world's nuclear reactors are not immune to disasters, human errors, natural disasters, and other serious incidents, perhaps terrorist attacks, cause disaster. And also, one could say, well, what about the nuclear waste? That's still never been resolved. What do we do with the nuclear waste? We could and should, in my opinion, go down the route of renewable energy, but there's a massive lack of investment in this. Any excuse, if you like, to get out of it. The government are doing everything they can to avoid anything green, and they're really stepping back, as you probably noted. And bills going up are blamed on the green agenda, which is not true. And fossil fuel multinationals are all backing up that whole area and stopping it from happening. There's also the whole question of scale of renewable energy that's required as well to satisfy our current needs. In effect, we'd probably need solar panels in every building. We'd look at all the land we'd actually need for biofuels, biotechnologies as well. And we're still going to run into problems even with all these scenarios because, you know, our current transportation systems, everybody, not everybody, but lots of people have personal cars. How are we going to run those on renewable energies? You know, so the whole thing is actually, you know, quite a mess, really. A bit science fictiony, really. And there's new scientists, new science that's coming out, which is quite interesting. It's about using photosynthesis, but an artificial form of photosynthesis. So we can sort of use the same sort of energy systems that plants use, but we're decades away from that. And it's just, you know, way into the future, lack of investment as well. So this technology is into the distance, and it's not really going to be a situation where we can adopt it globally. There's also issues with regards to food, as you're probably aware. And yes, there's genetic modification. Some people positive on that, some people negative on that. It's always at the loss of biodiversity, though. And there's situations with regards to water supply. They're looking at desalination plants, but they use a lot of energy, and they pollute and cause global warming inherently. And there's even some crazy suggestions called geoengineering solutions. The greatest one, I think, would make a good title for a pop song, but actually in reality, it's umbrellas in the sky. So you have these big solar umbrellas sitting in the on the hemisphere, and they reflect back the sun's rays and bounce them back to stop the earth from cooling. So, yeah, these are some crazy ideas that are going on at the moment, which shows, I think, how concerning these problems are, that these ideas are even being suggested, you know. And, of course, we continue to frack to get more fossil fuels out of the ground and cause more global warming. Mm. So, that was the technological solutions, and it doesn't seem they're going to be the solution that we need. So it seems the only other alternative then is a radical behavioural change. So a change socially, politically, economically. Our policies at the moment aren't, you know, they're not set up for this at all. They don't tell us to consume less. They don't talk about, they talk about GDP, and that is what we want. We want to boost GDP. We want to boost spending and building, and yes, this is the current systems that we are living under. So so what I think is we've reached a point where we can't seemingly solve the problems facing us within our current worldview. And I think we need a radical transformation of our systems and structures and our society. We do need a revolution. Obviously, I'm talking from a Buddhist perspective here, a peaceful revolution. So James Lovelock, those that know him, is an independent scientist, and he came up with the idea of the Gaia Theory, and well worth reading for those that don't know stuff. He suggests in one of his books, Revenge of Gaia, a new book of knowledge, a manual for those interested in the state of the Earth, and a primer of philosophy and science. And in it we'll have a huge range of knowledge. And he suggests even that we write it in ink that won't fade, on paper that will last a millennia. He's kind of talking about a new Bible, a new religion, a new ethics for the new millennium, if you like. And I would agree entirely that the eco-crisis is just as much a religious crisis as it is a technological, social and political crisis. But I don't obviously think we need a new religion or a new ethical philosophy. I think we've already got one. So although at the time of the Buddha, some 2,500 years ago, there weren't any of the environmental issues we were now facing, I think it has, maybe it's not the silver bullet to solve it all, I think it has a lot of the answers, yeah. It's environmental in its very nature. Its principles are based on loving kindness, on non-violence, on truth, and it offers a path of transformation, not only for the individual, but for the world community. I'm not saying that we all need to convert to Buddhism. It can be considered a secular religion, and one can quite clearly practice meditation and ethics without calling oneself a Buddhist. The teachings of Buddhists, however we frame them, are what is important here. And obviously one of the key teachings of Buddhism is the interconnectedness and the interdependence of all beings. And this could equally be applied to the environmental crisis. We can't look at the crisis in isolation. I've completely lost it. Yeah, we can't look at it in isolation. Social, political and economic strategies and policies all have an impact. Our economic system is based on growth and global capitalism and all based on this whole idea that human happiness and well-being are increased by purchasing stuff, basically. And this has all led us, in a way, into the mess we are now. And I think this actually comes down to the illusion of a separate self, which this is what really causes us that unhappiness, that we become more and more isolated and estranged from the natural world. We're not connected with the world. And this makes us act in ways that are detrimental to not only ourselves, to others and to the planet. So Buddhism, at its very heart, seeks to shatter that illusion of that we are fixed, we're separate, we're independent. And it seeks to show that we're all interconnected, from the stars and the planets down to the smallest amoebas. We're all interconnected. We have an effect on ourselves, on others. We have an effect on the other side of the planet. So a Buddhist response to the eco-crisis would be infused with a sense of liberation, the taste of freedom. That's what it's about. It will connect us more deeply and richly with others and with the natural world. So it will mean we'll have to have the courage to let go of old patterns, of old habits, of ways of seeing ourselves and our sources of security stuff. And it won't be in the spirit, though, of a sort of a self-denial or miserable self-denial. But really, it's a journey of adventure and an opening out to life. So green Buddhists have coined the term eco-sattva, which I mentioned earlier. So this conjures up the archetypal bodhisattva who has vowed to end environmental suffering. So eco-sattvas take their work into any field of environmental concern, whether that's some of the things I've talked about, agriculture, water pollution, climate stabilisation, wilderness protection. So the opportunities are endless. And the work carries the strength of the Bodhisattva vow to help all those that are suffering. So those practising with the framework of the Dharma and the Eco-Sattva trainings are based on the five precepts, but with an environmental agenda. So I'm going to run through, well, you'll recognise these, but the eco-sattva precepts. So, at the heart of the eco-sattva's life is the first training, non-harm. So non-harm is not a rule or an observance, but it's the state of heart and mind. In each situation, we bring to bear whatever wisdom and compassion we have, and we try and avoid causing harm. So our actions can have unintended and unseen consequences half a world away, ignorance at or not looking at the effects of what pollutions we emit, what goods we buy, and that all alienates us from life. And it's not that we're just connected through our material transactions. There's a deeper level in which life is intrinsically connected, and we see that in our relationship to others. If we're harming other life in this way, then we're harming our own life. We're not separate from others, so we can become more aware of life and less bound with our own self-centred concerns. So, the next precept, generosity, is a powerful act because it undermines the notion that we act out of self-interest and that economic growth is good. So revolutions arise when people stop buying into the regime or the ideology that's oppressing them. And there's a call for freedom. If the oppressions of westernised society is materialism, then generosity is its opposite. Individual acts of giving and sharing, that builds communities. And that's what a community is made up of. And they can free us from a sense of self. So we need to share our resources, whether it's locally, with, you know, the new community, for example, nationally, we need to share, and globally, you know, and this will make a fairer world. So I think, as you can see, this is, it's all very much interconnected. Yeah, you can't just take the environment as one aspect of it. Yeah, we need to create a more equal world. Thirdly, simplicity. So what we consume all it has hidden costs. So whether those costs are economic, environmental or social. And so the most effective response is simply, and it is simple, consume less and consume more simply. So living a simpler life is not to deny ourselves things just for the sake of it, but rather to strip away the inessentials of life so that what is essential can shine through. And Sangha Rachita calls this an aesthetic simplicity, and it's a quote from Sangha Rachita. The truly simple life glows with significance, for its simplicity is not the dead simplicity of a skeleton, but the living simplicity of a flower or a great work of art. Truthfulness, precept 4. So our voices are part of the ecosystem. When we see something that needs to be communicated, we need to do so. We need to learn how to speak out skillfully in a way that can really be heard. Practicing, for example, non-violent communication and other skills to understand others can all help increase skillfulness in this area. We must speak out, but with care and with equanimity. Speaking out as a fundamentalist is not going to help anyone, and I know about that, so I don't recommend that. But speaking out as and when it's needed, and when it's going to be heard. And fifthly and finally, the last ecosattva precept is awareness. So the Buddha teaches impermanence, everything changes. And even without the ecological crisis, nothing, not even the earth, is fixed, substantial and permanent. We're all fragile. And the more we understand this, the more we'll see how precious life is. I'm putting on a previous talk here, but Dennis Potter's last interview, he'd been advised that he had incurable cancer, and he writes about the apple trees blossom in his garden. I'm sure some of you have heard this before. So he looks out and sees this apple blossom, and he sees it is the whitest, frothiest, blossomest blossom that there ever could be, and he can see it. Things are much more trivial than they ever were, and more important than they ever were. And the difference between the trivial and the important doesn't seem to matter. But the nowness of everything is absolutely wondrous. And if people could just see that. But how can we be confident this is so? As with everything in Buddhism, it's not a question of being intellectually convinced. It's a matter of trying and testing it out for ourselves. If we live a life of non-harm, of generosity, of living simply, and speaking out for life, then we will experience an interconnectedness more and more deeply. It will show itself as a natural love towards others and a sense of beauty. We will not be able to sit by and watch our wonderful world die. We will want to change what we are doing to destroy it and become a revolutionary. So I'm going to finish with one last quote from the American cultural anthropologist Margaret Mead, which I think sums up the American response to the eco-crisis. And I hope it resonates for you as much as it does for me. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.